You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, 25 federal agents will be coming to Milwaukee to help local law enforcement deal with violent crime. Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley joins the show to share his thoughts on the operation and what questions he still wants to have answered. First, new data from the U.S. Labor and Commerce Departments paints a bleak economic picture for the country. Just this week, we learned that between April and June, the country's economic output, GDP, fell at a historically high rate. We've also seen some increases this month in the number of people applying for and receiving unemployment benefits. All this while the federal unemployment benefit enhancement expires and the Senate, House of Representatives, and White House appear not too close to a deal on further economic relief legislation. There had been some signs of recovery in May and June as we saw some coronavirus-related restrictions eased, but that growth seems to have slowed down. Noah Williams is the Julie Plant Granger Professor of Economics at UW-Madison. He's the founding director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy. Noah, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, that quarterly GDP number got a lot of attention, a 9.5% drop from the previous quarter, and as I understand it, from the quarter the year before, 33% sounds like a big number annualized. Can you put those numbers in perspective for us?
So in simple terms or in broad outline, we've never seen a drop this large, this rapid in history. Of course, there's good reason for that. The economy was largely shut down, particularly in April and into May. But again, to give some perspective, the 9.5% quarterly drop is about four times the quarterly drops that we saw during the Great Recession in 2008. So again, very rapid and very large magnitude, really unprecedented.
And the big hope, of course, was that we'd bounce back quickly or almost as quickly as that drop happened. What have we seen so far in July?
Yes, we've actually seen across a number of different measures a tapering off, slowdown of economic activity in July. The official data, you know, lags what's going on in the economy. The release, which came out yesterday, was, you know, backward looking. It's almost, through the end of June, so roughly a month old already. Looking at some other higher frequency data, both the unemployment claims that you'd mentioned, as well as some other measures of foot traffic and business activity, we've seen really slight decline or more broadly stagnation both within the state and nationwide throughout July.
Before we go toward future prospects, I want to talk about a little bit about the way economists are doing their jobs right now. As you mentioned, you know, this quarterly statement, that's from almost a month ago now, the data included. I understand economists are really scrambling to try to get more up-to-date stuff because this thing happened so quickly. What kind of things are we turning toward to try to understand where we are, not last month, but now-ish?
Yeah, there's been a real rise. It's actually been really helpful. A number of private companies have made data available to researchers, which has been great for us. So particularly at Crow, the center that I direct, we've been focusing particularly on Wisconsin, but also nationwide. And some of the things we've been looking at, one measure to get a sense of real-time economic activity is based on mobility, basically tracking people's locations, visits to commercial locations from their cell phones. So there's one company that we work with that has a sample of roughly 10% of the population, and then we can track how frequently are people going to the store, going to grocery stores, going to restaurants, and so on. And using that data, we saw a very rapid drop in March, you know, right as the pandemic took hold. We saw overall mobility, overall activity drop by roughly two-thirds year over year throughout March and April. Then we actually saw a relatively rapid bounce back in May and into June, but then we've seen that level off. So there's foot traffic data. There's also some other private data on transactions of people spending on credit cards, which also spending has actually held up a little bit better than some of the other measures of activity.
Talking to Noah Williams, professor of economics at UW-Madison and founding director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy, looking at the latest economic news, much of it bad, and what to look forward to in the future. Noah, I've seen some economists say, and I've heard from some of them on this show, you know, this isn't an economy problem anymore. We've got to solve the pandemic. We've got to get this thing under control if we're going to get the economy back on track. how much truth is there to that as you see it?
Yeah, I think that's undoubtedly the case. You know, I mean, again, think of kind of where we were in January, February. The economy was very good. Then even though, you know, the government orders and the shutdowns got a lot of attention, it was really a pullback in economic activity by individuals and businesses in March, which happened before any of the lockdowns. Similarly, we did see a relatively rapid bounce back in, you know, up through June, but then we've seen that taper off, and even more so in some of the states like California, Arizona, and Texas, Florida, which have seen even more of the spread of the virus. So it is really the case that the virus and its prevalence is really dictating how rapidly we can bounce back.
The debate in Washington now is whether there should be another round of economic recovery spending and how much. Democrats in the House saying $3 trillion, Republicans in the Senate saying only, I'm throwing quotes around that, $1 trillion. What level of spending would you like to see, and what do you think are the best targets for that kind of spending, whatever the amount is?
Yeah, so honestly, somewhere in the middle would probably be reasonable, and again, most likely where we will end up. One of the sticking points is the extension of unemployment benefits. You know, as we may have discussed earlier, people are getting $600 per week. The unemployed are getting $600 extra per week from the federal government in unemployment insurance benefits. There's concerns. This is something I've written on as well, that this provides a disincentive for people to get back to work. In the midst of the pandemic, this wasn't really an issue. You know, we wanted people to stay home, and there wasn't really a lot of firms hiring. As we've moved towards reopening and recovery, that becomes more of an issue. So that is one of the main sticking points, whether to provide those extended unemployment benefits or to scale them back or tie them to going back to work.
Let's bring on a caller. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question for your guest is that we know that the economic shutdown also has a human cost. Is there any type of factoring or equation that allows us to see when is it right to shut down the government, or maybe a more limited shutdown of the government versus the human cost for any other illnesses, especially those going forward, like the flu? When does it justify shutdown, and when does it not, based on the economic and human costs of what's going on?
Charlie, thanks for the call. And I think you meant shutting down the economy, not the government, Noah. But Charlie pointed toward the human cost of the economic damage weighed against the benefits of shutdowns to slow down the pandemic.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a clear answer to that. Obviously, it's a difficult comparison. We've you know, given my background, we focused on the economic cost, but clearly there have been, particularly you know, as in say March and April, when a lot of other hospitals, non-essential hospital services were shut down, there were some real health effects of that, and we've actually seen, you know, increasing costs of isolation, deaths of despair, that type of thing. So it clearly goes beyond just a pure economic calculus.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. Noah, do you see bright spots in the present or on the horizon when it comes to a possible economic recovery?
I mean, one of the things which has been surprising, or in really in some ways points to the role that policy has played in helping to smooth this crisis, is that consumption and spending have actually bounced back and been relatively strong. I mean, it did collapse in April as most things were shut down. But with the sort of stimulus rebate checks, as well as the enhanced unemployment insurance, people's incomes have been able to remain relatively high. So, you know, the bright spot, of course, is hope that we do get this additional spread under control and ultimately do get a vaccine, which will allow us to resume more of some sense of normality.
Noah, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Noah Williams, director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy and an economics professor at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about the steep drop in the U.S. economic output numbers in the second quarter of this year and where we might be heading now. Coming up, Milwaukee's county executive shares his thoughts on federal agents being sent to Milwaukee to help deal with violent crime. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump floated the idea of delaying the November election yesterday and continues to say that the results are going to be rigged. We'll talk to a constitutional law expert about what a disputed election could look like. First, 25 federal agents from the FBI, Drug Enforcement Agency, and U.S. Marshals will be coming to Milwaukee as part of the federal government's Operation Legend aimed at dealing with violent crime. When the move was announced last week with few details, many Wisconsin leaders opposed the move and feared a repeat of events in Portland, where unmarked agents had arrested protesters without apparent cause. But at a press conference yesterday, the U.S. Attorney for Wisconsin's Eastern District said the agents would be focused only on assisting local authorities with crime in the city, not racial justice protests, or with next month's Democratic National Convention. David Crowley is the Milwaukee County Executive. Executive Crowley, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob. Always a pleasure.
Now that we've had some more details on what this operation may look like, what are your thoughts on these federal agents coming to work in Milwaukee?
Absolutely. So, I mean, when they first was announced that they were coming, I mean, the first question that came to my mind was why? What is going on and what is the reason for this? And so we ended up sending a letter to the United States Attorney Matt Krueger to get more information. And so the whole point of this Operation Legend is to send more federal agents to come down basically here to Milwaukee County and cities around the country to help support many of our local law enforcement officers. And the reason is they want to be able to address the violent crimes, drug trafficking, and the illegal use of firearms. This was originally announced in the beginning of this year as Operation Relentless Pursuit. And then later on, I think in sometime in June, it was then changed to Operation Legend after the four-year-old died in Kansas City, Missouri.
Initially, when these announcements were made over the last week or so, they kind of seemed like they're part and parcel with what we've seen in Portland when it comes to federal law enforcement agents being reassigned to deal with counter-protest movements and to protect federal property. It looks like this is something pretty different from that, right?
It is something different than that. And that was one of the reasons why my first initial reaction was why. We've seen in Portland what was happening with many of the protesters, but what we have learned is that in Portland, they had Customs and Border Patrol agents working with the Federal Protective Services, and they were literally deployed to protect federal courthouse and to be on the front lines as it relates to the protesters. And when we think about the protests that have been happening here in the city of Milwaukee, they've largely been peaceful. And so to get that reassurance from the United States Attorney that they're not here to be on the front lines, they're not here to actually interact with Milwaukeeans in general. They're just here to really provide that back office support for our local law enforcement. So that does relieve some heartburn. But we do want to make sure that we're doing our due diligence in making sure that nothing outside of that scope is happening.
Now, you tweeted recently, I think before this announcement, Milwaukee needs federal aid, not federal agents. Does the way these federal agents are being used to answer that concern that you had shared on Twitter?
Oh, it does relieve some of that heartburn. But when you think about the what's been happening right here in Milwaukee, here in Wisconsin with the rise of COVID-19, it was really about making sure that we're doing our due diligence to save everybody. But we do welcome helping out our local law enforcement if that is the case. Again, it's really about accountability and making sure that all of the questions that we have as local officials are answered.
Now, unfortunately, Milwaukee is one of a number of communities where we've seen an increase in violent crime, 97 homicides, I believe, so far this year, 52 more than last year at this time. What do you think is the key to lowering that number in the short and, of course, long runs?
Well, it's always about working with the community, right? I mean, we have to make sure that we are working with the community members that are on the ground, but also working with our law enforcement as well. But at the end of the day, we just need to make sure that everything that is happening is transparent and clearly being communicated to the public and local officials in order to tackle this issue. One of the things I can tell you is that and a disturbing number, one of the reasons why we've seen an increase is because of domestic violence. And so we need to make sure that we are on the ground, especially during these challenging times when many people are suffering financially or spiritually, mentally, to do everything that we can to give everybody a sense of safety.
Talking to David Crowley, Milwaukee County Executive, looking at the role of federal officers coming to work in Milwaukee aimed at preventing violent crime. They have said the Wisconsin Eastern District U.S. Attorney has said not similar to the role that they have been used, other agencies have been used against protesters in Portland. Getting back to the crime issue, Executive Crowley, I've heard concerns of, you know, with declining police community relations, there's a problem. Police feel under attack. Communities feel like they don't feel secure calling police in difficult situations. How can a community like Milwaukee start to build or maybe rebuild that trust?
Well, I mean, one, it starts with communication. We know that we've seen the trust between many different communities and law enforcement erode over the years. And so it's really about making sure that, one, we have open dialogue about what 21st century policing look like. I mean, many people can tell you that we as a society have abused our local law enforcement. Sometimes we call the police for things that we shouldn't, whether we're talking about a cat being in a tree or somebody barbecuing or just bird watching. We need to have some cohesiveness and really work well with one another and bring more diverse voices to the table about what does policing look like, but also how do we give accountability back to the community to make sure that we're doing our due diligence in restoring the trust that has been lost over the years.
Now, looking ahead, the Democratic National Convention is scheduled still to happen in Milwaukee in mid-August, much smaller than the original plan, but still an event with a need for security. How are you feeling about the prospects of keeping it peaceful and safe for everyone?
I feel like it's going to be peaceful and safe for us and safe. I mean, as you, everyone is well aware, the footprint of the DNC has really decreased dramatically. And so the fact that they are still coming is a plus here for the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. We absolutely would love to have a DNC, a full throttle DNC, and we're going to continue to push for that in the next 4 years, crossing our fingers. But we want to make sure that, you know, when the nomination is handed over, we want to make sure that it is safe, that we are supporting whoever is the nominee may be, because here in Milwaukee, we definitely understand that this is not something that we get all the time. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get a Democratic National Convention or any national convention, whether it's the Republican National Convention or Democratic National Convention, to come to our city and really showcase what we have to offer. So we are really excited about it, and we're going to do everything that we can to make sure that it goes off without a hitch.
I want to talk about kind of the view of Milwaukee from the outside. I know from the suburban area around Milwaukee, the rest of the state, maybe even the country, when you say the name of a big city like Milwaukee, especially when you see some violent crime numbers going up, people don't feel like it's safe. They feel like it's a threat to them in the surrounding area. They don't feel safe going there. What would you say to them?
Well, Milwaukee is definitely a place to come. I would tell folks who live here, who don't live here, that this is a hidden gem that many people don't get a chance to really enjoy. When you think about our Bradford Beach, which is one of the most accessible beaches, the most accessible beach in the country, you know, we have a lot to offer here. And many people may look at and see what the news may say about Milwaukee, but I highly encourage anybody across the state and across this country to come see Milwaukee for themselves. It's definitely a city that you will fall in love with. And you may just want to come here to work, play, and just to have, you know, have your children go to school here. We have a lot of different amenities when you think about our park systems here in Milwaukee County. But this isn't the place that many people may think as far as being one of the most violent. I think any big city that you may go to that will have its share of issues. But right now, we're doing everything that we can to minimize the violent crime here in the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. But I just want folks to understand that this is a really safe place to come. You can definitely come here to enjoy all the amenities that we have to offer.
I want to touch on another issue, the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, going on all over the country. In the early days here in Wisconsin, the Milwaukee area, the Milwaukee County was one of the hardest hit. Mm-hmm. People of color, black residents disproportionately affected. What do you see happening? What do you want to see done when it comes to resources available to deal with this thing?
Well, we can definitely use more direct and flexible funding to make sure that we are providing the critical services that many folks need. I mean, Milwaukee County is the safety net for many residents across the county. Unfortunately, we don't have a health department, so we weren't able to stay ahead of this as a county as we wanted to. We have 19 different municipalities, 11 different health departments, so it's kind of hard to have one cohesive message. But we are doing our due diligence, working with the public health officials, working with businesses, working with our community partners as well to stay ahead of the curve when it comes down to COVID-19. We would love to see other communities do something as it relates to mask policies. We've seen that the governor recently did a mask mandate. But at the end of the day, you know, that's not what's going to solve our problem. That's just one tool in a toolbox. So we have to remember the three W's, which is, you know, wear a mask when you're out in public or you're with individuals who may not live within your home. Make sure that you continue to watch your distance, making sure that you practice physical distancing and washing your hands. So we just need to make sure that we all understand that we are in this together and we all need to rise to the occasion to make sure that we get COVID-19 past us.
Briefly, as we wrap up, I want to bring it back to where we started, federal support for local law enforcement. You say from what you're hearing now, you feel reassured about the federal role. What are your hopes for federal and local and county cooperation on violent crime in the area?
Well, I'm hoping that it will go off without a hitch, and that again it's transparent and clearly communicated, you know, to us as public officials, but also the community. We need to rebuild that trust, and when with them coming in, if this is the reason that they're coming in, we welcome that. But what we don't welcome is a presence of outsiders who wants to escalate any tensions with peaceful protesters. So we're gonna work with our local law enforcement officials, with our sheriff's department, to make sure that we're solving many of these cases. But again, you know, we want to reassure the public that this is not what we've seen in Portland.
County Executive Crowley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
David Crowley is the Milwaukee County Executive. He was with us to share his thoughts on 25 federal law enforcement agents slated to come to the city of Milwaukee to help local authorities deal with violent crime. Coming up, President Trump has left the door open for disputing the results of the fall election and floated the idea of delaying it past November 3rd. We'll talk to a constitutional law expert about the different ways the election could play out. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7 on The Morning Show, long-serving State Senator Fred Risser is leaving office at the end of this term. He joins the show for a look back at his career and tells us how Wisconsin politics have changed over the decades. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump took to Twitter yesterday to renew his frequent claims that the November election will see a lot of fraud because of mail-in voting. And he floated the idea of delaying the November election until people can, quote, properly, securely, and safely vote. The power to delay an election lies with Congress, and both Democrats and Republicans were quick to dismiss that idea. But President Trump hasn't said he'll accept the results of the election if he loses. That's raised some questions about what happens should the November results come into question. Edward Foley is the Ebersold Chair in Constitutional Law at The Ohio State University and Director of the school's Election Law Program. His books include Presidential Elections and Majority Rule and Ballot Battles, the History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Ned, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, good to be with you, Rob. Thank you.
Let's start with this notion for the president of delaying the election because of concerns over mail-in vote fraud. What would it actually take to officially delay a U.S. presidential election?
Well, as you said, Congress has the power to choose the date for the elections, and it's unlikely that Congress is going to do that. They've already said no, as you mentioned. And the most important thing to think about is the Constitution, which has a hard stop in terms of the end of the current presidential term, that the term ends at noon on January 20th, no matter what. So if there's not a lot of time, right? I mean, if you even theoretically delayed a month, you still have to make sure that you can count all the votes and be ready so that the new president can take office on January 20th or the second term if President Trump were reelected. But his first term ends no matter what at noon on January 20th.
We saw in states around the country during the pandemic, some states postponed their primary elections in the presidential race. Here in Wisconsin, our governor tried to postpone the primary and a state election that included a state Supreme Court justice that was ultimately rejected. Is there a difference from a legal standpoint between those decisions and a president delaying a presidential election or calling for the delay of a presidential election?
Yes, absolutely. Primaries are, funnily enough, very complicated creatures because they're both the way the parties choose their nominees. And of course, for a presidential election, that's complicated because you've got all the different states feeding into the national conventions. So primaries are a hybrid creature of both internal party law and then the state law for each primary. The general election in November is different. And of course, the November general election is both the presidential election and the congressional election by federal law. So as much as the presidential term comes to an end at noon on January 20th, the congressional terms all end on January 3rd. So America needs a new Congress as well as a presidential election. So the idea of delaying or postponing the November 3rd election just doesn't make sense from an election law perspective once you focus on it.
Talking to law professor Ned Foley from The Ohio State University, talk about President Trump's suggestion that the November election should be delayed, concerns of mail-in vote fraud, and the speed at which the election results get tallied. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to President Trump talking about some of these issues yesterday at a press conference. Here's a listen.
I don't want to delay. I want to have the election. But I also don't want to have to wait for 3 months and then find out that the ballots are all missing and the election doesn't mean anything. That's what's going to happen, Steve. That's common sense. And everyone knows it. Smart people know it. Stupid people may not know it. And some people don't want to talk about it, but they know it.
And the president had said elsewhere he wants results on election night. Now, we often think we have results. We call presidential elections on election night. We don't really have results on election night till they're certified often weeks later, right?
That's absolutely correct. Anything on election night is unofficial. And as you say, when the networks or the Associated Press call a race, that's really a projection on their part to try to help their audience about what they think is going to happen. But the actual election results, as you say, are certified by government officials, and that takes time in every year. It often is just a formality in the sense that the certification confirms what the networks predict will be the result on election night, but it's not official until that certification happens.
And there's been a lot of talk. I keep talking to political experts who say this year, with more people mailing in ballots, we in the media and the public at large should be ready for the concept that we might not know who won the presidential election or Senate elections or whatever on, you know, by the end of Tuesday. What do you think?
Oh, I think that's definitely true. I think it's quite likely that there won't be the possibility of unofficial projected results on election night. And the reason for that, as you say, is that this year, there's every expectation that the number of vote-by-mail ballots will be far larger than in the past because of the pandemic and because of rules, appropriate rules associated with the counting of vote-by-mail. It takes longer. Now, there may be ways to change the law to try to speed that up some, which could be advantageous, but even with some adjustment in the counting process, it's reasonable to expect that there will be a delay. I don't like to think of it as delay because, again, it's just the normal process of the official results happening that would happen anyway. The only thing that's delayed is the unofficial expectation that you know what the answer is going to be.
Now, the president in that clip used the 3 month figure there, and that's what some people see as a nightmare scenario. The loser of the election not accepting results, challenging mail-in ballots, lawsuits in one state and another state that have key electoral votes. Do you worry about a worst case scenario? I guess if that is a worst case scenario.
I do worry that uncertainty could metastasize, if you will, into disputes that just spin out of control. I hope that doesn't happen. It doesn't need to happen. Uncertainty isn't automatically a disaster. America has had presidential elections in the past where the winner has not been known for a couple of weeks. But at the end of 2 weeks, in the two cases that I'm thinking about, both sides agreed as to what the result was. It just took a while to pin it down. That's a good result, even if it's a delayed result. So we may, again, have a two-week delay. It doesn't have to end in a problem. Where things get more problematic from my perspective is if the two sides keep fighting on and they go to court and they refuse to accept defeat. And there are ways in which that kind of scenario could get ugly. And I could walk you through the mechanics of how you could move from November 3rd to the meeting of the electors on December 14th to the meeting of Congress on January 6th, and then Inauguration Day, January 20th. Those are the kind of main pivot points. And we could imagine a process unfolding where it remains disputed sort of every step of the way.
We're talking to Ned Foley right now, chair in constitutional law at The Ohio State University, about President Trump's claims of potential mail-in voter fraud and his suggestion that the November election should be delayed, and what happens if election results end up being disputed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about some or all of those things I just listed? What questions do you have about what happens if a candidate chooses not to accept an election's result? Do you share the president's concerns about the accuracy of an election where more people are likely to be voting by mail? And what do you think of this notion, the suggestion of delaying Election Day? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Ned Foley, chair in constitutional law at The Ohio State University, author of books including Presidential Elections and Majority Rule, talking about President Trump floating the idea of delaying the November elections. Doesn't seem likely to happen. Also, questions the president is raising about the reliability of mail-in voting, wanting election results on election night. You can join in with your thoughts, reactions, and questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president, raising the idea of delaying the election? Do you worry about mail-in ballots? Are you worried about a long wait for election results, or are you okay not knowing when you go to bed Tuesday night, Election Day, who the next president or senator or congressperson is going to be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, let's talk about the mail-in ballot question. The president saying again and again he thinks that a wider access to mail-in ballots will lead to widespread fraud. What do you think?
There's just no evidence for that. And the important thing, I think, to note is that every state, including Wisconsin, has procedures to verify the validity of absentee ballots. They don't automatically get counted just when they arrive. And you may be reading about rejection rates. Sometimes they're too high. But the important thing to realize there is that there's signature matching that has to happen. And so we have procedures to assure that the ballots are valid ballots, and therefore to challenge the result requires evidence to say, here's a ballot that shouldn't count. If there's evidence as to why a particular ballot shouldn't count, the system is prepared to receive that evidence. But running elections means being willing to accept the result if you use the process for determining the result.
I wanted to ask you about the role of state legislatures when it comes to certifying the outcome in a respective state. And obviously, there's a partisan lean to any given state legislature. What is their role?
Yeah, this can get a little bit complicated. I'm happy to try to unpack it. And it may actually be useful to go back to that disputed election of 2000, Bush versus Gore in Florida. Because there, the legislature in Florida was thinking about asserting a constitutional power to appoint electors directly when the legislature was starting to think that the system had gotten so mired down into the hanging chads and all of the issues that were in litigation there that it was unknown what the popular vote was. And the legislature said, well, if we can't determine the will of the voters, we're just going to appoint electors ourselves. They didn't end up doing that because after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against Vice President Al Gore, he accepted defeat, and the legislature said, well, we don't need to do anything. But that example shows that at least there's a theoretical possibility that you could have a similar fight, you know, in any of the battleground states this year. And what that would look like, I think, again, it's hypothetical at this point, but you'd have the normal processes of government achieving an answer as to who won the popular vote using the mechanisms that law has of the counting process and a recount if necessary. And so say there's that certified result. In theory, if the legislature didn't like it, it could try to repudiate it by saying, we're going to appoint electors ourselves, the way the Florida legislature thought about doing. That would be contested. I think it would likely go to court. I think there would be strong arguments that the legislature doesn't have that power unless there's a genuine situation where there's been a failure to determine what the will of the voters themselves are. And even that would be complicated. So I think it would be unbelievably messy. And it would remind, and none of us were alive back in 1876, but if we dust off the history books, we know that the most disputed election in American history was Hayes versus Tilden that year, 1876. And that was a situation where in several states, there was such a fight that Congress received conflicting submissions from each of several states. And that is a very precarious posture. I hope nothing like that develops, but our legal system, you know, at least as a matter of theory, makes that a possibility.
Now, some have read the president's remarks about mail-in voting fraud as an attempt to, I guess, cast doubt on the outcome should he lose in the election. Does that concern you if that's the case?
Well, I think that does lead to what is the most important point. We hold elections to determine the will of the voters, right? The Declaration of Independence talks about government deriving its just powers from the consent of the governed, right? Elections belong to the people to determine the will of the people. It belongs to all of us as we the people, those first three words of the Constitution. So the question is an election successful in doing that? Again, except for Florida 2000, we almost always say we can achieve an answer that is a valid answer because it's what the people want. Now, the other truth about elections is both sides can't win, right? Every election has a winner and a loser. And the system only works if there can be common ground as to what that answer is, whether your side wins this time or not. It's taking turns, right? Sometimes my side wins, sometimes your side wins. The system allows for taking turns. If you can't accept defeat, you can't really run an electoral process. So you have to start with the presumption that the certified result is a valid result, unless you have some reason to reject it. And so the question will be in November, when there is a result, will it be accepted? Again, the presumption should be, yes, of course it's to be accepted because we held an election so the voters could tell us what they want, right? The elections aren't for the politicians, it's for the voters. It would only be a strange anomaly if the legislature decided, well, we're just going to repudiate the result because we don't like it. That would defeat the whole purpose of the election.
In just our last minute or so, what do you have your eye on between now and November when it comes to pulling off that kind of successful election?
Well, I do think there's going to be challenges because of the virus and their capacity issues. In Wisconsin, you saw this back in April, right? It's essential both to make sure that every voter who requests a vote by mail ballot gets it. That means the voters, if they want one, should apply early and not wait to the last minute. And then we have to avoid the kind of long lines that many of your listeners will have images of in Milwaukee in particular. We saw these pictures of people waiting for hours. Both those are capacity issues. Every voter who's eligible should have an adequate opportunity to vote. And that's going to be a challenge this year because of the virus. I mean, I hope we pull it off and that there's no risk of disenfranchisement. If we have problems, we have to ask, are the problems big enough to really affect the outcome? If there's some problems, but they're not large enough that we can still trust the result, then the election will have served its essential purpose to give us a winner who takes office because the voters wanted that person to win.
Ned, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Edward Foley is chair in constitutional law at The Ohio State University. He joined us to look at President Trump's suggestion of delaying the November election and what would happen if the loser of the election challenged the ultimate results. The Milwaukee Bucks return tonight after the NBA suspended play in March over the coronavirus. The team leads the league heading into the final stretch of the regular season, but unfortunately for the Bucks, they won't benefit from home court advantage at Fiserv Forum. Megan Hart has more on life inside the NBA bubble in Florida.
When the team arrived in Orlando 3 weeks ago, players were required to quarantine in their hotel rooms until they passed two coronavirus tests. Bucks star Giannis Antetokounmpo says he couldn't complain. His suite is bigger than the apartment he shared with his four brothers in his native Athens, Greece. Though not everyone enjoyed the experience.
Feel good to feel the sun again. That's for sure.
That's veteran shooting guard Wesley Matthews, who spent the quarantine period unpacking.
Set my Xbox up. That was the first thing.
He says he brought some scented candles to remind him of his place in Wisconsin, and he added one more item.
Brought a picture of my daughter and I. Got that by the nightstand.
Several Bucks players say the hardest part of being in Florida is missing their families. But the Bucks organization has made an effort to make Orlando feel like home by sending truckloads of equipment and even reproductions of artwork from the Milwaukee weight room to Orlando. The NBA Finals are set to wrap up in mid-October, and shooting guard Matthew says the team plans to be there for the duration.
It's been a whirlwind, but we're blessed to be down here. We're blessed to be able to be in the situation to fulfill what we started the season out on, which is trying to win a championship.
Florida has nearly 500,000 cases of the new coronavirus, but the Walt Disney World campus, where teams will live and play over the next 2.5 months, has been dubbed the bubble because of its strict coronavirus precautions. Players are tested for the virus every other day. They have the option of wearing smart rings that measure their respiratory and heart rates to help with early detection, and contact with the outside world is very limited. There's even an anonymous hotline where players can report social distancing or mask violations. But Bucks shooting guard Dante DiVincenzo says he doesn't plan to use it.
I mean, I'm more so worried about myself and the guys on our team. And I know that we're taking every precaution, following all the protocols. So I think we're worried about ourselves.
So far, the NBA's plan seems to be working, especially compared to Major League Baseball. Baseball season started last week. Already more than a dozen players from one team have tested positive for COVID-19, and a handful of games have been postponed. Plus, DiVincenzo says life in the NBA's bubble has been pretty good.
They did a great job of giving us resources. We can play golf, got the pool outside.
Players from across the league have been sharing their experiences on social media. They're playing cornhole and ping pong. One of the top exports from the bubble so far is pictures of big men holding small fish from Disney's lakes. Players like Matthews and Antetokounmpo are also practicing other skills. Bucks small forward Sterling Brown has played an active role in the recent social justice movement sparked by the killing of George Floyd. He says he plans to use his time in the bubble to continue learning about and speaking out on issues of race and equality.
It just feels good, man, like I said, to be back out here, and it feels good to have this, you know, isolation time for myself to educate myself on, you know, our current situation and circumstances.
Players have the option of displaying a social justice message on their jersey when play resumes tonight. Browns will read Liberation. Players say living on a campus with 21 other NBA teams is a bit strange. Many know each other well from years of playing with and against one another. Here's Bucks center Brooke Lopez.
In that regard, the bubble feels a bit like you know, one of your high school summer camps.
His brother Robin also plays for the Bucks. Both are big fans of Disney, who visit Orlando several times a year. Brooke says he's given Coach Mike Budenholzer a list of about 20 Walt Disney World restaurant recommendations for team meals. The Bucks play the Boston Celtics tonight at 5:30. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll find out how a group of farmers in southwestern Wisconsin has banded together to protect water quality in a local watershed. A lot of people are curious about camping these days, as many travel plans are off the table. A Wisconsin expert gives us Camping 101. You can join in with your questions and advice. and just when you thought it was safe to go into the woods. Well, it's still safe, but we'll hear about a rare carnivorous plant spotted here in Wisconsin. That and more, all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 8, get an update on the latest COVID-19 developments with the Wisconsin healthcare leader. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's Food Friday. We'll talk about what to do with all those tomatoes, zucchinis, peppers, corn, and other great summer produce this time of year. You can get started with a few recipes right now over at wpr.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.